Okay, yesterday on our journey to see ourselves as we really are, we got to the point where we were starting to appreciate interrelatedness, interdependence and impermanence. But before going any further into an appreciation of that or those things, I wanted to slow down a bit. We've got plenty of time. And take a bit of a time out and just go back a bit to appearance and reality, this taking things to exist in the way they appear, and sort of drill down into it a bit deeper, because otherwise it's very easy to think, oh yeah, I've got the idea intellectually, but then you might actually forget the formulation of it by next week and it's not really sunk in. So some might kind of take a deep breath if I say I'm going to dive deeper back into that detail, but I think it's worthwhile to try, because you may take something away from it that's not just, although it will involve some words and other things, it won't then just be an intellectual understanding, but it'll also be, oh yes, and best of all, give you the kind of tinderwood to light your own fire with it, to think, oh, I can, that kind of appreciation or realization or whatever it was will open up other possibilities or things you can investigate for yourselves. Yeah. Also important too, you know, I go on at the speed that I do, with the kind of sentence construction and all sorts of other things that I do that are pretty idiosyncratic. Not everybody here has English as a first language, so really don't hesitate to stop me if you think I'm going too fast or you haven't got it. Yeah. Or if there's something, and I think we've been pretty good with that, it's like, oh, well, what about this or what about that? Feel free to do that, because I can always say, oh, can we park that for a moment? I want to get there. Or we can deal with it there, or I can deal with it at the end. So, yeah, the sort of enthusiasm and wanting to go for it is a good thing, but sometimes it's good to slow down. And maybe, well, then you might be, as a teacher, familiar with the business of, if you want a really, really good overview of things, that kind of umbrella view, and to have, you know, the sort of top of information over a lot of things, you kind of have to sacrifice the depth. But on the other hand, if you drill down really, really, really deep and don't pay any attention to this one, the old English expression is, you can't see the wood for the trees. So I want to get that balance right. And I think with the appearance and reality thing, we might have like a good introduction to it, a vague idea and a kind of overview of it, but we've not dug down into it enough to really get fascinated and spark things in ourselves that might make me think, oh, yeah, I can look at things in a slightly different way. So that's where I want to go. So it's looking a bit deeper into the fundamental nature of our habit. It's partly a habit and partly the way we're constructed, partly the way we're made. And I think one of the important ideas to remember of is this one of that you may get insight into an illusion. If it's a good illusion, it won't change, but you'll be able to see it differently. Yeah, it's not the insight into it will suddenly make it look any different. It will appear the same as it does, but you won't be taken in by it. So that's quite an important idea. So this idea of mistaking appearances for reality, for thinking that things exist as they appear, and assuming, among other things, and I think importantly, that they're much more solid and concrete than they are. Than they actually are, that's the one we want to challenge. Yeah. So just a quick recap from the perspective of the teaching of the Buddha. the existence of suffering, first noble truth, suffering, all conditioned things, everything that appears to us, everything that we experience is marked by dukkha or suffering. And I think we're all quite clear about what the Buddha means by suffering there. Or do you want to explore that a bit? Just suffering of suffering, coarse physical and mental suffering, suffering of change, and deep, pervasive suffering. Yeah? From the Buddha's perspective, that's not a necessary feature of the world. Right? Nor is it the consequence of a specific story or fact about the past. You know, it's not, for example, because we scrumped an apple in a vengeful old creator's garden. Yeah. So it's the suffering exists because of perceptual and conceptual error that leads us to be mistaken about the way things actually exist, taking appearances for reality. So it's produced by a wrong view, an active misconception of the world that is now so much a part and parcel of our habitual way of thinking that we're not aware of its thoroughly relative and perspectival nature anymore. We don't even see it. Yeah. There's a philosopher contemporary, well, reasonably contemporary, philosopher called Thomas Metzinger. And he labelled this phenomenon as transparent. And what he meant by it was, it's a conscious world model that's active in consciousness, supported and dependent on mechanisms in the brain. And it's transparent if the brain has no chance of discovering that it's a model. One looks right through it, onto the mind, as it were. Something like this is going on in the way we perceive and conceive the world. Yeah? So yesterday we spoke about how, if we can realize that things don't exist in and of themselves as they appear, independent of mind, then even though they continue out of habit to appear that way, we can at least know that they don't. So insight becomes a way out. Even though because of the transparency, it won't change, we can say, I know what that one is, you know. Much in the same way that if we go to watch people who perform magic on the stage, however astonished we might be, we know there's a trick. Yeah, and it still appears that way if they repeat it, and it still fascinates us. But we no longer think that something miraculous is happening. We know there's some sort of sleight of hand. Well, with this one, the sleight of hand is going on in virtue of our physical organisation and our consciousness, you know, mind and brain, and the kind of five senses and mental consciousness that we have. So there's an optical illusion that you're probably all familiar with, that I'll show you it again. It's called the Muller-Lyer illusion. Lyer not in the word as to lie, because it's a L-Y as a name, but it's interesting we've got that double barrel name. I'll turn it into a good little first. Yeah, you know this one? You know the Muller-Lyer? Are you familiar with that one? So it's really quite easy. These two lines are actually the same length, but it appears that the top one is shorter than the bottom one, or that the bottom one is longer than the top one. And there's also an old Tibetan saying that refers to long and short. And of course,
There's no absolute long or absolute short. This one only appears shorter relative to this one, and this one only appears longer relative to this one. So there's no inherently existing long or short. They're just relative terms. Why I think, although it's simple, this one is so good is because it shows you in a very direct and simple way that even though you know what's going on, if I said, does anybody doubt it, do you want to come and measure it? You'd say, no, Roy, we know. Yeah. But it still appears as if one is longer and one is shorter, even when you know. Yeah? So that kind of example, and any good illusion, will show you, so there's an optical illusion, that mere intellectual insight into the fact that the two lines are the same length doesn't alter the fact that the lower line appears to be longer, but we can at least appreciate it for what it is. So it shows us that an illusion is not something that does not exist, but something that is not what it seems. Huh? So to say something is illusory doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There it is. It exists as an illusion, but it tricks us into thinking it's something that it's not. But the contention here is that's what's going on with us, the way we perceive the world and ourselves all the time. And mostly we don't notice it. We're asleep to it. You can think with some other things, like, what is the sky? You know, there it is, out there. But okay, where does it start? Where does it finish? Where are its boundaries? We quickly get it, oh yeah, that's just to refer to that up there that's not the Earth. But a lot of the time we think, oh, it's a thing. It's a sky. It's like somewhere covered around with some crystal glass dome, but of course it hasn't got any dimensions, it hasn't got any qualities. It's even the colour of it is entirely dependent on so many different factors that it's very difficult to see that the sky has any kind of inherent existing from its own side sort of existence at all. Or what about the clouds that appear in it? And another philosopher who happens to have an interest in Buddhism, he's a Western philosopher with an interest in Buddhism, Jan Westerhoff, he put it rather beautifully, so I've nicked his rather poetic prose for you. He says, clouds might appear as soft as white pillow, as a white down pillow, as thick as a dark wall, or as far reaching as the golden sands of the desert when illuminated by the setting sun. But really, nothing of the sort. In fact, they're little more than the thin air into which they will soon melt. And I think I saw one here when I arrived on Saturday, where it looked like this with some clouds around the edge. And within about 5 minutes, it was dark black and pouring with rain. And 10 minutes later, it was broken. And yet, each of those perceptions of mine, and even knowing a bit about clouds, I saw them as much more solid and concrete and fixed in time than they actually were. So the aim of the Buddha's teaching is not just to show that all things are like illusions because the way they appear is different to what they are, but to bring about a radical and complete change in the way we can perceive and conceptualize phenomena, such that ignorance or avidya is cleared away and the suffering we experience as a result of it ceases. Yeah? Our suffering is based on that kind of misperception. So I thought your question about the chocolate was a good one to drill down deeper into this, because yesterday we were talking about the same thing, but you were talking about it at the level of
the reality of your preferences or not. And I said, well, actually, the tin itself might be more interesting for this purpose, to really drill in there. So it, even more narrowed down than that, what about the colour on the label of the tin? It's deep purple kind of colour on the chocolate tin out there. So colour vision, what's that about? It's the ability to distinguish different wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation. Yeah? So colour vision itself relies upon a brain perception mechanism that treats light with different wavelengths as different visual stimuli, and consciousness interprets them as colours. So the colour insensitive photoreceptors, the rods in my eye, do not see this as yellow. And there is no yellow in there, in that cloth. All that's happening is electromagnetic radiation, as light is being perceived by photoreceptors that are not colour sensitive, and a mechanism in the brain is doing something with it. So colour appears. Yeah, it appears that the colour exists out here from its own side, independent. If I go away and come back, it looks the same. Not dependent upon anything else, but in actual fact, the colour doesn't have any inherent existence. It's a phenomenon or an appearance dependent on causes and conditions. And as you rightly say, if you've got a different animal with different mechanism, then one of the causes and conditions for its perception isn't there, then it ain't there. Is that to say that colour doesn't exist? No, but it doesn't exist in the way we think it does, ordinarily. Yeah? It's, the more you think about it, the more kind of profound it can get. So if you look a bit more into that, those colour insensitive receptors, the rods in the human eye, only react to the presence or absence of light and don't distinguish between specific wavelengths. So colours, or colour as we see it, it's not inherently existing in the paper of the label or anything else, for that matter. You know, they're not existing as they appear out there, independent, concrete, existing wholly from their own side. They are synthesized by our brains to distinguish light with different wavelengths. And interestingly, you know, why is that so? It's evolutionary. Yeah. And with human beings, evolutionary biologists think that that was developed so that we could know that it's better to eat ripe fruit than unripe fruit and things like that. Yeah. So while the rods give us ability to detect the presence and intensity of light and allow the brain to construct the picture of the world around us, specific detection of different wavelengths through independent channels gives our view of the world additional higher resolution. We bring that to the party. It's not the way it actually exists. And red and green colours, to your point, look like near identical shades of grey in black and white photographs. So that's what you see. So an animal with black and white vision alone won't be able to make a distinction between a green and a red apple, and won't know which one tastes better before trying them both based on colour. The difficulty is, most of the time, we don't say, oh, this is an illusion which is indicating for me which is good or bad. We think it actually exists like that. That's the mistake. We don't see it as an illusion. We say, oh, it really exists like that. That's the That's the mistake that's been pointed to. There's nothing wrong with the illusion. It's not that the illusion doesn't exist. There it is. Yeah. But if we mistake it for something more concrete, more solid and more real than it is, then it can cause problems and suffering for us. There's nothing either good or harmful in the appearance itself. The problem is how we interpret it. Mm. Yes, certain causes and conditions give rise to certain things, and then they will have a certain result. So if there are things that are poisonous to the human organism, and I eat them, I'll be poisoned, yes? This is not an illusion, no. As I was saying, it's not that the illusion doesn't exist, it's that we don't see it as an illusion. For example, poison, to me, to the human being, it's a good example, might not be poisonous to another organism. So, if I view, say, deadly nightshade or belladonna as an inherently existing poison from its own side, not dependent on all those other causes and conditions, right? Actually, I can synthesize something from it, drop it into the eye, and it's very helpful. So relative to me eating too much of a certain quantity to it, we call it a poison. Other animals will feed off it. It's not inherently good, bad, poisonous or not. The idea of poison, labelling it as a poison, is because of the effect it has in certain circumstances and conditions. And if we see that, that's fine. But if we suddenly think that, oh, this plant is inherently evil or horrible, it's a fantasized way of imagining its existence. You see, it's a subtle thing, but it's a good, really good question because it gets at it. It's like, oh yes, it's like that. So this is not the illusion that's being attacked, but how we understand it, how we interpret it, what we do with it, what we infer from it, and then the way we almost mechanically, we'll do a few more like this that are interesting, kind of then just screen out and say the world's this way or this phenomenon's that way when it's actually not like that. But the way the brain and the consciousness have evolved to do this has really high survival value, and nobody's knocking that. But if you don't understand that, then you can make all sorts of inferences or interpretations, or because it's transparent, not even be aware that it is that way, and then assume that somehow all this is out there, existing in and of itself. You know, not that colour is a phenomenon that we're able to see. For me, if you look at some of the Dzogchen texts, they'll particularly talk about appearances as being a magical display. Well, I don't know how you feel about it, but if I just think, oh, it's a bit of dyed cloth, that's one thing. But if I call to mind for a moment that the colours on this cloth are a living, vivid, moment-by-moment appearance that's dependent on my being here to see it and all sorts of other factors in a vibrant, ongoing, living world, that's really quite magical. It's not just dye in a cloth. It's not just out there. It's a very different experience, no? Even if it looks the same. With anything you do, I wouldn't restrict it. With absolutely anything, yeah. Yeah. It's worth the depth of the trick, if you like.
Yeah.
Even though that we've arrived there for very good evolutionary reasons, if the consciousness is kind of blind to it, then it's going to interpret the world in a certain way and act in a certain way. And many of those things, although, for example, the colour, let's assume evolutionary biologists are right, but bearing in mind, even the best evolutionary biologists can only offer us a theory, which may change over time, exist as it were, they're not, their models or explanatory models, again, there is nothing completely independent, inherently existing on its own, out there. You know, it's like, is there any inherently existing, completely independent, not dependent on anything else, kind of God's eye view of reality that somehow we're missing out on? The answer is no, from the Buddha's point of view. Yeah, because of this, that happens. The kind of our experience arises on the basis of ever-changing causes and conditions. Oh, but there are similarities. Well, of course they are, as you were pointing out yesterday. We're all human beings with the same sort of five senses and the same sort of brain and the same sort of structures in the brain and similarly conditioned consciousness. But wasn't there one that went more than a year ago before a Christmas viral with somebody putting their wedding dress on the internet? And then there was just an astonishing number of people commenting on, well, what colour was it? I mean, in actual fact, all that kind of heat was like forgetting some of the most basic things, like, well, actually, if you look at the same colour in slightly different lights, it looks slightly different. If you photograph it with different phones and different lenses, and do it will all appear different. I mean, here again, when we were talking about, it's not what goes on over long periods of time, but as I'm sitting here talking about the colours on this or anything else, the sun out there is actually moving. You know, we're not thinking about the sun moving, but if you think, oh, well, of course it does. It rises over there and it sets over there and it gets dark. But what's happening is it's slowly... Well, actually, it's not doing that. This is a good one, isn't it? We're actually going round it. But it took us to get as far as Galileo and Copernicus before that was actually proven. And even though we know it, it still looks as if the sun's going round the Earth. The illusion doesn't change. It's just that now we know. Yeah? And even then, you see, as I'm talking about it, I have to remember it. That's how powerful it is. But as the sun's moving, the light in the room's changing. So all these colours and how I see them are varying. There's the shadow of the computer here. It's not the shadow there. So on and so forth. And all of that is constantly changing. Whereas our normal behaviour, as part of what I was trying to say there as exhibited, takes this very fixed view. And sometimes in order to create some space and stability, there's evolutionary value to that. And there's nothing wrong with it. But if I'm not aware, if I'm not present to that happening, and then mistake it as existing in a way that it doesn't, then all sorts of problems can arise. That's the proposition. So, I mean, going back to what we're saying is, and also to the point about the evolutionary biologists, it's a good theory. You know, they've found as good an evidence as they can. And you think, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. I can see that works. But who knows what else may be going on there, how that theory may evolve, but the because you can see how that would kind of obviously provide an advantage in a competitive natural world, you know? But it's still why certain wavelengths are paired with particular colours remains a mystery. Why this particular electromagnetic wavelength of light is interpreted by whatever sort of organism as that particular colour is totally and utterly mysterious, even here in 2019. And it's what neuroscientists and others studying consciousness find so exciting. Whereas to us, it just becomes boring and very ordinary. Up to a point, but even that's relative, no? Well, yeah. Because
if we go back to our evolutionary biologist theory, then I'm attracted to the red rather than the green apple because I think it's ripe and it's really nice. Yeah, but some animals turn themselves red to other predators because that predator will interpret it as danger. So even our interpretation depends on the circumstances. Yes, there are some circumstances where even we associate red with danger, partly because of the mechanism, and I would say almost to a larger part because we've decided as a culture socially to say this is the colour for danger. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then you get all sorts of other by effects of sort of odd side effects of it, and that's, I don't know whether it's still true, but once a time if you looked, and I knew it when I was working, doing some work for the Department of Transport, red cars are more often involved in car accidents than cars of other colours. Interesting. But what I'm saying is nothing is ever reducible to just one cause. All of these things are playing, aren't they? The way we perceive the colour, the kind of people that buy that colour car predominantly, but not everybody who's like that buys a red car, it's dependent arising. All these things arise dependently on different causes and conditions and can appear completely opposite in one set of causes and conditions to another, pointing again to the fact that there's no inherently existent, independent from its own side sort of thing. Does that make sense? It's another really good example. Yeah, we normally associate red with danger. But when it comes to ripeness in fruit, another story altogether. Other people, meditators and Buddhist meditators, you know, we're all rightly, you know, excited, even His Holiness is setting up the consciousness studies and neurophysics and all of that. And it's rather pleasing, you know, at the moment it's rather pleasing because there's been tons of research done on meditation and what's going on. And we're all really delighted because it conforms our biases about it. Well, what if one of those models or paradigms has to change? Watch out. It might not be the same. It's relative. But if we think, I can't argue to somebody else that their worldviews are dependent on a relative model and then claim my own are built on some sort of reality that theirs doesn't have. It's not possible. So you have to, exactly, you're right, be careful. But you get what we're just on the precipice. I wish I could get us to jump over the cliff. There is no inherently existing universal reality. There's no such thing. But does that mean it doesn't exist? No, it does. But everything, moment by moment, are appearances to us arising on the basis of causes and conditions. And when they change, is different. Does that make sense? There is no independently existing from its own side, singular, completely independent of anything else, reality. It just doesn't exist. Does that mean that what we're experiencing doesn't exist? No. There's the illusion, it exists all right, but it's not the way we see it. Yeah? So everything, all our experiences arise when the causes and conditions for them to appear like that, yeah. But if they change, then everything else changes. Well, it's a shared experience. I mean, the minute details might be different in the sense that my eyeballs are not your eyeballs, yeah. But and you know, whatever's going on there. So although we might both see it as red, we might see it as a slightly different red. Or if there was something wrong with my eyes, we might see it quite different. There are people who are colourblind. So they see, if you're red-green colourblind, what I'm seeing as red, a red-green colourblind person sees green. Yeah. Very, and yet again, so how do people with serious colourblindness get on? The world still looks the same to them, but they're able by insight to train themselves to know that when they see red, everybody else is seeing it as green. It's not that they suddenly start seeing red as green, it's that once they're taught
and they recognize it and have some insight into the condition, then they know how to deal with it. Yeah. Does anybody remember or see the film A Beautiful Mind? Yeah. So that's actually an example of what's going on, that in therapy, if you like, people with very serious psychotic interludes can get to deal with it. But it's not that the hallucinations or the delusions go away, it's just they're able to see that they are and not mistake them for reality. You know, there's a voice in my head telling me I've got to do this, so I have to do it. No, I don't, it's just a voice in my head. Has the voice in your head gone away? No, but I don't take it seriously anymore. Mm-hmm. We view it a different... Do you see what I mean? It's not, mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, I think that's where we need to go with it. But it's types of... Karma's good, but I think sometimes we make it more mysterious than it is, because in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit word karma means action. Right? So if there's an action, go back to the Buddha's teaching on causality, if this happens, then that. So, karma in action. I'm going to act. Result. That's hitting your ear, you can hear it. That's karma. I've created karma by acting. Yeah? But there's all sorts of things I do at a more subtle level that I might not see as clearly as that. Or there may be things I've done in the past that I've forgotten. So I don't see that karma. Yeah. But what I'm living with today is the result of all those previously done actions. It doesn't exist in the way that it appears. The illusion exists, all right. We exist, all right. This exists, all right. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's really important, that one. It's a really good question. It's that it doesn't exist in the way that it appears to us. That's the important one. The intention here is there isn't some other extra real reality. If you like an epistemological question, what's the difference between something I have no way of knowing and it not existing at all? And more to the point, which I think Lama Yeshe's point is the better one, if that's the case, what does it matter? Yeah, as a regulative ideal, I wouldn't knock it. I'm a proponent of scientific method. But I don't think, if somebody said to me, so do you think it's possible that one day you're going to get there? The answer is no. Because, we can't know. Sorry, yeah. So what I'm saying is, but if we're using maps or models, yes, if I'm using a map, the map is never going to become the mountain.
True.
And the mountain's changing all the time. So the maps have to change to fit the mountain. Are we ever going to reach a point where we say, that's it, job done, perceive reality? Theoretically or logically, I can't see how that's ever going to be possible. But anyway. Do you think it's ever going to be possible that, I think it's right back to what I was saying at the beginning, we've got five senses and mental consciousness. Is it possible for me to have any experience of anything dependent on these? Yeah, science. We can't talk about it. I'm just trying to come back to the basics to say, this is what we have. So the important point, particularly from the Buddhist perspective, therefore, is it possible that we could have any knowledge or experience of something that is not in some way dependent on our way of experiencing it? And thousands of millions of years are not going to change that. So from wherever we started to where we are now, or if we went into the realms of science fiction, and before the Earth disappears into the sun, we manage through, say, it's complete science fiction this, to transfer our consciousness to an AI platform, no longer have bodies and have a different sensibility and way of sensing things, what we experience will still be dependent on that.
and relative to that. It won't be dependent on the five senses and mental consciousness anymore. It'll be dependent on some new platform. You can't kind of take that out of the picture. Does that make sense? We can't take ourselves out of the picture and say, oh, we're going to meet a situation where it's never going to be dependent on us. Or never going to be dependent on the sensibility. Anyway, I've run into... We'll continue. It's fun, isn't it? It's 11, so I'll modify the... Let's come back at 11:20. And we'll do...